Okay. And I think we have counsel coming in for our last case of the day here. Marshall, go ahead and call the case.
Now calling A240774, A240781, State of Minnesota respondent versus Jacob Carl Smith, appellant.
Okay. While counsel's getting settled, I'll just remind everyone that as you probably know, you have 15 minutes for your initial presentation, as well as counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And just a note for everyone here today that you can see we have two judges and we're missing Judge Bjorkman. She's unable to be with us in person, but she is observing the live stream of the arguments. So she's unable to ask questions, but is definitely observing and will participate in conferencing this case as well. So with that, the timer is at 15. Feel free to adjust the podium as needed. And also, just please recall that we'd like you to introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and identify your party. And with that, counsel, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Greg Scanlon, and I represent appellant Jacob Smith. We are asking that his sentences in this case conform with Section 609.035 and with the diminished criminality of the conduct for which he was convicted. I have a few brief comments about the appellant's position generally. First, I think the two legal issues in this case are fairly clear and should be clear. We need to make sure they're clear. It is the state's burden to prove separate courses of conduct. And second, all of the factors, time, place, and criminal objective, are to be weighed. They are not disjunctive. Willis is wrongly decided and without support in the case law. Second comment is that the facts charged in this case here are unusual. I am not suggesting that a person could never get more than one sentence under the Danko statute. I think I described in my reply brief ways that that could happen, perhaps even in this case on a different record. Third, my professional development as a public defender for 12 years in district court did foster concerns generally about potential abuse of the Danko statute. I believe that a sensible, justifiable, and effective exercise of discretion is very important, and I don't believe that that happened here. For instance, Mr. Smith got 36 months in prison based on a Danko that arose from a gross misdemeanor charge. Mr. Smith was in jail for all of the charged conduct. And certainly, jails have some amount of capacity to block a phone number, to restrict access to incoming video calls, as were made in this case, or even to simply report illegal conduct that's happening with the phones or with the jail's video calling equipment. Indeed, the state could have charged one or more Danko cases at any time in September of that year, which might have actually discouraged the contact if that was the state's goal. Arguably, that wasn't the state's goal. Most importantly, if we really want domestic abusers to be reformed, to be rehabilitated, to understand their conduct and learn from it, they need to admit to it. I think it's in everybody's interest if domestic abusers admit to assaults. And what the Danko statute does in practice in cases like this, it threatens, the state is willing to get rid of the domestic assault charge, so it doesn't have to admit to that, in return for, in this case, piled on punishment for Dankos. More punishment, less accountability is not a good way to address domestic abuse.
Did your client understand that he was prohibited from this conduct at the time he was making it?
When he pled, he said that he did understand. This Danko had been in place for 2 years. There had been an exception given at one point because he and SLB, I should say, with respect to SLB, had been in place for 2 years. And they had an exception for, they were actually doing some counseling, some couples counseling, some family counseling. And so I do think that, if you look at the language of the given Danko, I'm not sure it was perfectly clear to him. Again, he admitted to it at the plea that he knew it was in place and that he knew he was violating it. I think it's possible that a person in his situation could believe that when I'm in jail and I can't have any physical interaction with the person, can't touch, can't hug, can't whatever, maybe that doesn't count as contact. Again, usually a Danko order, the standard Danko order certainly makes that clear that even like a phone call counts. But yeah, he knew that he was violating the both of the Dankos. As far as the legal issue of whether the three factors, all of them being dispositive, it is the Munt case, the U.S. Supreme Court. It is the Munt case where there's first this idea that that's where the word or is used. Unity of time and place or same criminal objective. And for that proposition, it cites Bauer. Bauer, in the Bauer case, that's also a Supreme Court case. And the Supreme Court in that case actually found that there wasn't unity of time and place. There wasn't unity of time and place. And yet they went ahead and also weighed the criminal objective. If Munt's use of the word or is the rule or was the rule, the court would not have done that in Bauer. And
Do
the
we
court.
know that? I mean, even if courts don't have to reach an issue, they sometimes do for whatever motivating factors, perhaps to, something like that. I don't know that that's the correct conclusion to draw.
Well, how about the fact that Munt, when it was decided, the word or had never been used before, especially early in the cases. They talk about totality of the circumstances, they talk about weighing all the facts and circumstances, and they all talk about those factors. In fact, the early cases talk about the criminal objective being the most important part. And it's that idea of what we're looking for a separate course of conduct is. They use the phrase a break in the continuum. And I know that continuum usually means time, but what they're talking about when they say a break in the continuum, they're talking about a break, a change in the criminal objective. And that's what all of the cases before Munt, they all make the criminal objective the most important one. And there is no other case before Munt where they either decide time or place or both and then end the analysis there. More to the point, after Munt, I mean, one could argue, well, Munt intended to change the law on this topic. But no, De Groot came after Munt. De Groot was a couple years later. And again, in De Groot, if Munt is the rule, if it's enough to find that time or place were not satisfied, if finding time or place not satisfied means you don't have to address criminal objective, that's not what they did in De Groot. In that case, there were separate, it was separate times and separate places. That's the one where it was a solicitation offense in the morning and an actual attempted offense in the afternoon. And the court said, nope, that's different times, that's different places. And we also are finding that there was a break in the continuum. The criminal objective was different. And when you look at the individual facts of what was happening in the morning, what was happening in the afternoon, that it's two different criminal objectives. And so if Munt is the law, De Groot is a very easy, it's a very easy case. And so the other thing I would say about Munt is in Munt, there were 10 charges altogether. There were seven victims. So seven of the charges are justified on the multiple victim rule. And so to some extent, there's some of Munt that has to be dicta. We don't even need to decide if this threat to the Good Samaritan who's coming and the aggravated robbery of the stealing the minivan or the SUV or whatever from the two people who were just also kind of randomly stopping by. We would, we, that's not even relevant. That doesn't have to be decided in the case. Those are three victims. And so we're not even looking at 609035 in terms of object, the criminal objective or time and place. The multiple victim rule applies.
But here we're looking at specifically at a violation of a Danko order. And
right.
So a Danko order typically applies to usually one person, right? The prohibited contact is as to one individual. And the only way to violate it is to initiate or have contact, whatever contact it is that's prescribed, whether it be in person or in addition to that, the phone calls, the texts, etc. And so when we look at applying the case law to this situation and this particular offense, then I think we are looking at did he have the intent to violate the OFP as to that person each time he did it?
Yes, and I'm glad you made that point, because you look at the case, there's the case with the multiple drug sales. There's also the case with the multiple, I believe, possession of pornography or something. And just the mere definition of the crime, they talk about it be that being too broad of a, just saying that he, like in the drug cases, oh, he just wanted to sell as many drugs as he could to make as much profit as he could. And what the court says is that doesn't make it a single course of conduct, because that's too broad of a that's too broad of a criminal objective. And that application of that in this case is when the prosecutor stood up and said, judge, what he's doing is he's just flouting that judge's order saying he can't have contact. That's what he's doing in all of these cases, in all of these calls. If that were the criminal objective we were talking about, yeah, that's too broad of a criminal objective. That just the fact that he's violating, I can't stand here and say, you know, he's violating the Danko, he's violating a Danko every time. And so that's what they all have in common. That's the criminal objective. And so that makes it a single course of conduct. It doesn't. But we have more than that here. We have a lot more than that here, because we actually know what the content itself of the calls was. He wasn't just picking up the phone and saying, I'm calling you because I want to make the judge mad who put this order in place. I'm calling because I want to be, you know, a
but
pain.
But is the reason for the contact ever really relevant to the fact that the contact occurred?
It's relevant to the criminal objective. Again, it's this, again, what we're looking for is a break in the continuum. Is there somewhere where his criminal objective, what he is, the purpose that he's trying to attain by committing this conduct, by picking up the phone and having a conversation, by accepting an incoming video call, the purpose, his criminal objective in doing that, it has to change somewhere for it to be multiple courses of conduct, multiple counts. And that's the state's burden. And again, this is the part in my reply brief where I say, maybe you could find that. Maybe if we knew if the individual calls, the content of the calls was in the record, you know, I think what I said was maybe there was a call, four or five calls in, where it was unwelcome. She picks up and says, I'm sick of talking to you, stop calling me. That would be a change in the continuum. But as far as we know, everybody, the prosecutor, the defense, everybody describes these as just benign, everyday, mundane relationship calls. How are the kids? Let me say goodnight to the kids. What do you need money for? How can I help you get money? What's going on? How was your day? That sort of thing. And so again, maybe there would have been a way to prove a change in that continuum, a break in the continuum of just mundane, everyday, hi, honey, how was your day kind of calls. Maybe it was there, but it wasn't proven. It wasn't demonstrated. In fact, the state continually said the opposite. Judge, there's nothing here to see. In fact, when it was going to trial, the state wasn't even going to put the content of the calls in evidence. Just the very beginning where his name is stated on the recording and she says her name. The rest of it was just too bland and mundane for the jury even to hear. Again, or unnecessary to establish a violation. But again, this is what makes this unique. I mean, we know how those calls often go. It's, hey, don't show up for trial. Hey, you don't want me to go to prison, babe, right? I mean, if that stuff was in there, that we would have heard it. They would have played it. They would have wanted to play it for the jury. They want to make him look like a manipulator, an abuser. And there isn't any evidence of that.
I guess I'm trying to understand where in the statute you find authority for us to differentiate based on what the content of the calls was. What is the authority for that?
Well, it's because of those cases that say that tell me that I don't get to say, look, he violated the same crime all these times. That makes it the same criminal objective. And, you know, and that's the drug case. That's the child pornography case where there were seven different downloads over a period of 8 months. And the defense tried to argue, well, it's the same conduct every time. Of course, it's a same criminal objective. And you're just not allowed to divide. I'm not allowed to define the objective that broadly. And so that's why we have to look closer at the individual conduct to see what the conduct is and what the objective is of the conduct as it continues. And again, that's it, the statute is very broad, very vague. And over the years, there's a ton of different ways in which the court adds some nuance to this. At times they describe it as whether all of the conduct was incidental to each other, incidental or necessary to each other. They talk about the purpose of 609.035 as to avoiding disproportionate culpability. We don't want to give somebody too many sentences for stuff that we don't want to exaggerate his culpability, which is why we limit it if it's all part of the same criminal objective. Again, they talk about breaking the continuum. In Stevenson, neither act, and this was a case where there were two different assaults of some kind against the same person, but like 5 hours apart. And they say, the court says, neither act bore an essential relationship to the other. And so without them having that essential relationship between the two crimes, there's not a single criminal objective. And so they look closely at what that conduct was.
And counsel, we are at 15.
Thank you.
So I will say thank you for that. We're going to turn it over to attorney for respondent for 15 minutes. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel, you can adjust the podium. Please remember to introduce yourself and your client at the beginning of your presentation. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Sean McCarthy. I appear today on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to pick up right where you were at, Judge Wheelock. Where is the authority in the statute to use this differentiation of a single criminal objective? It's not in the statute. What we have is what was asked about earlier by Judge Hallbrooks. We have courts doing what they do all the time. You know, this is kind of a tricky question, and here's one way to think about it and part of our analysis, and here's a secondary thing that further supports that conclusion. We as lawyers and judges always look for multiple reasons to explain our rationale. That's what makes this area of the law a little bit mushy. And I've never used the word mushy in an argument like this. This is a big moment for me, but I mention it here for you because it is mushy. And why? Because the concept of when does one crime stop and a second crime begin? That's an important concept in the law, but there's some tension between that concept and an equally important concept. We don't want to unduly punish somebody by piling on too many things that were really all the same event.
Because you brought that up, I am curious if you could address specifically the fact that there were convictions, I believe, for multiple calls on single days. Okay, and that goes to both of the DANCOs that were in place. So we have a situation where on September 10th, there was only 7 hours and 32 minutes between the calls. September 19th, 1 hour and 45. September 12th, 7 and 45. But I think we also have a contact where on the 13th of September, there was only 36 minutes between them. And there's a couple of others, another one with only 19 minutes between them. How are we to determine exactly what you just pointed out about where does the criminal objective and the time element come in to say whether or not those were the same or different offenses?
The key here is picking a time is simply too arbitrary. 1 hour, if it's longer than that, that's a separate crime. Less than an hour is separate. You know, that would be just randomly picking a number. And that's why, as I said earlier, the courts, and the reason the tests are phrased a little differently, is because the courts are looking for, how can I carve out this case a little differently? What I would argue, and this is something I would encourage the courts and your staff attorneys to consider, including some language to help clean this up a little bit. Here's one thing you could do. You could say that the longer the time, the more likely it's, you know, that's a factor that weighs the further the time gets, it's more likely to be a separate offense. For example, if I walk into a store and steal something, and a year later walk into the same store and steal the exact same thing, same objective, stealing from that particular victim, that particular store, but a year of time, that makes my point stand out here. That's what I'm kind of getting at. But it's arbitrary, and that's what makes this challenging. And that's where we get into, well, what are some things we can also consider that make it less arbitrary? The multiple victim rule for sure is one thing. And again, I would encourage this panel to include some thought and some language about this. Every time in the nature of a Danko violation, a domestic abuse, no contact, I'm emphasizing the word contact there, the break or change of contact is significant. There's room to argue, as counsel and I are arguing, you know, every time you stop a call to one victim and start a call to the same victim, is that break of the call enough of a break? Well, it kind of depends. If it's the same call and it got accidentally disconnected because somebody, you know, you lean your cheek against the touchable cell phone and it disconnects your call and you immediately call back, is that the same call, the same effort? There's an argument you had to make the call again, but that's a weaker argument for this state. But if 7 hours goes by, that's a much more affirmative act of making that secondary call. So the point, though, I want to make about the multiple victims in a case like this, if the crime is contacting the victim and you're in jail and you can only contact one of them at a time, every time you change victims, you have clearly had that break in the continuum. You've ended the no contact violation with one victim, and you've started a new crime with the new victim. That's another way you can parse some of this. It still feels kind of mushy. It's a little arbitrary, but that's a pretty clear line. In a domestic abuse no contact, you got two people that you have no contact orders with, and you're calling the first one, and then you hang up and you call the second one. That's two crimes. Counsel just conceded that. Then you call the first one back. Did the first crime continue while you were doing the second crime? No. That's an easy break that makes logical, reasonable sense. Those are some of the things we can try to do to strengthen this. In reality, though, the fallback, and Judge Wheelock, to answer your particular question about this, the way that Munt and Stevenson and the other cases both counsel have argued in our briefs, the way this really plays out, it's not you have to consider all the factors. It's, gee, these are hard to parse out which is which. You may consider these factors. And in some instances, a really long break in time, a totally different victim, a completely different place. That by itself is enough in some cases. And in the closer call cases, we tend to then start looking into, was there a single criminal objective? For example, counsel was relying on Stevenson, I'm sorry, DeGroote. There's a break in time between the morning offense and then 45 minutes later, the actual criminal sex offense. They're two different offenses, soliciting sex and committing sexual misconduct. The argument here is that's another factor to consider as to, is there a break or not? Have we shown that break or not? And much of the early case law that counsel was arguing about regarding the kinds of offenses where we start parsing that concept of a single criminal objective, much of that case law were some of the tougher cases, the ones where, gee, is the drug dealer who's selling drugs in the morning and then 20 minutes later is selling again and 5 minutes later is selling to somebody else, different customers each time. How do we break that up? One way to break that continuum is each sale to a different person is a different amount. There are two concepts I thought of that I found useful. The Slow Thief and the Shaky Sniper. The slow thief is the guy that goes and breaks into the grocery store or Target or the gas station, and he opens the till, and he takes out a dollar. And he looks at it, he admires it, he's feeling, wow, this is great. And then he reaches in and grabs another dollar. Is that one crime or two crimes? Well, the closer it is in time, it's all in the same place, same victim, same thing, and it's within seconds of it, that's more likely to be one crime. But what if he waits a day and sneaks in through, you know, however he got in without detection the first time, and does it on a separate day? That's a separate crime. But we still got same place, same victim, same criminal objective. Time alone is the one distinguisher there. You see the point I'm drawing. We shouldn't place undue emphasis on any particular piece of this, except time in particular is the one that you can't stop. And the victim switching in particular, you can't stop. How can you have be committing a crime against one victim that involves contacting that victim and then simultaneously put that on pause and let it continue going on while you're also committing a crime with another victim? The only thing I could think of is like if you had, you know, a multiple phone call situation and you're talking to them both at once, that's not allowed at jail. So that doesn't have to come into play here, but I'm kind of getting into these bigger ideas because I think this is a mushy, sloppy area of law that has room on a closer call case to be very problematic. I would suggest that in response to the cites from the record about the times and the distance between the calls, which victim was being called is one way to parse some of those out. And the fact that this is jail. It's not like he's laying around and has ready access to communication equipment all the time. There are breaks in the continuum of the offense because, gee, I gotta go, it's time to go eat. Hey, I'm being cut off, it's somebody else's turn to use the phone. Those breaks stop the crime that's going on in terms of a no contact violation. And it takes an affirmative act to start up a new no contact violation. That's the emphasis I wanna get at here, is on that tension between when does one crime end and a new crime begin versus undue punishment. This is a person who made an affirmative decision in the context of the jail to specifically start a new communication. That affirmative act is pretty significant. Two other pieces that I think are worth considering as part of your analysis. Danko. There is inherent in the Danko statute kind of a contempt of court concept. You got to have a court order saying, no contact. And you are implicitly, at least in the way that that concept comes up, the offender is choosing to disobey that court order. That, I think, carves out Danko from other kinds of, that's different than the guy taking $1 and then taking another dollar. Gee, I got a court order telling me not to contact somebody, and I'm going to do it again and again and again, day after day. That's a different scenario. I think there's a way to rationalize that differently. I'm going to just look at my notes here. I've been told that judges like it if you stop when you're done. And unless the panel has specific questions, those were the points I wanted to get out. Oh, I didn't mention the shaky sniper. If somebody has a rifle scope, goes up on a sniper post and shoots at somebody and they miss because they're kind of shaky, and then they shoot again seconds later. And I'm not suggesting this answers the question here, but it was a useful way to think about this. Same person goes up the next day and shoots at the same person at the same place at 10 a.m. when they walk out of their office and misses a second time. Well, in the first scenario where it's seconds apart, is that one attempt or two attempts? And the second scenario where it's a day apart, is it one attempt or two attempts? It highlights picking a time starts feeling arbitrary, but it feels less arbitrary the longer the break in time. That's a factor that I think courts can weigh in. And some language from this panel pointing out that the closer it is in time, that's when you've got to really think about, are there other ways to parse this out? So in answer to Judge Wheelock, where you laid out the closeness of some of these calls, the closer ones, maybe there would be a way, or maybe there would be a good rule of thumb for the state would be if it's closer in time, you want to give your trial judge and your sentencing judge and your appellate judges some additional facts to parse some of that out. And that's where I would agree with counsel that some of those concepts come into play about a different objective or a different time. Sorry, that took a little more than I thought, but my goal here is if the panel has no further questions, I would concede.
No, we are good. Thank you. All right, so we will have 5 minutes on the clock and turn back to counsel for appellant for the last word.
Thank you. I'm going to add to the mushiness a little bit, which is that a lot of this, we're talking about how far do we look into the conduct and what is actually happening in the commission of these different offenses. It varies a lot depending on what the charge is. It's very easy to say in any given day, how many times did Bob assault Sam? But if you're talking about contact, how many times yesterday did I have contact with my spouse? Well, I mean, when we sat on the couch together watching TV, is that one altogether? Is that every time we stop for a minute, 5 minutes, then the next one counts as a separate one? Contact is messy. Contact, and that's what this is about. Like, how much contact did Mr. Smith have with SLB or with YSR? Or how many times? Or, I mean, at the ridiculous level, you count every word spoken or every response to something the other person says. At a bird's eye level, you would come to a very different answer, but that's what we have to decide. Is this a single course of conduct? Is it five courses of conduct? Is it 24, which is how many convictions he got? I actually just did a quick count. I might be wrong about this, but just looking at the addendum to the brief where I had them all set out and I disregarded the dismissed counts, if you do what Mr. McCarthy suggests, and just it's a new one every time the victim changes, that would only be 9 convictions compared to the 24, or 9 sentences compared to the 24 that my client got. And so there are lots of ways to sort of make sense of this, but you do have to look, you have to dig a little deeper than just, oh, he violated the contact order, You have to look at what the conduct is and whether those might be continuing conversations. And again, if they are different courses of conduct, it's the state's burden to prove that. It's the state's burden to point to those individual conversations and say, this is a brand new thing here. There's something different happening in this conversation with SLB than just happened in the previous one. I appreciate Mr. McCarthy also mentioning contempt of court. This is like contempt of court. It's exactly like contempt of court. Maximum sentence for contempt of court is 90 days in jail. And my client got 3 years. In addition to all the other crimes.
Don't we have to look at the context here with the domestic abuse? That there had to be a finding of domestic abuse had occurred and a reason for the DANCO to have been imposed as a protective measure for the person who's been subject to that contact.
And that's why I'm not challenging the fact that there was a DANCO put in place, despite the fact that my client still has never been convicted of a domestic assault against SLB or YSR. The domestic charge against SLB was dropped as soon as these DANCOs were charged. And the jury in YSR's trial acquitted my client of the domestic assault charge. And so I understand. I'm not challenging the existence of the DANCO. I am functioning completely within 609.035 and what is a single course of conduct. And again, this is a very unique case. These were benign. Mundane. I almost want to call them harmless, except they weren't harmless. He was helping. I mean, I suppose on some level, we kind of want to assume that every conversation an accused domestic abuser is having with the potential victim is some kind of manipulation or some kind of that wasn't here. The prosecutor would have said so if there was. She would have made a big deal about that. That would have been part of why she stands up and says, she asked for 8 years for the YSR DANCOs, wanted all 8 of them that were being sentenced to be consecutive. If, if, if there was something manipulative or abusive about these conversations, the prosecutor would have said so. I think I'll leave it at that unless you have any further questions.
No questions. So that concludes the final argument we're hearing here today. Thank you to both counsel for your argument and for the briefing. We certainly do appreciate it. And so an opinion, the case is submitted and an opinion will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe. So with that, we are in recess for the day. Thank you.
All rise.
Stop. Yeah.